On Friday, March 1st, 2024, Michelle Traconis was found guilty on all charges, including conspiracy to commit murder, conspiracy to commit tampering with physical evidence, 2 counts, and tampering with physical evidence, 2 counts, hindering prosecution. She is set to be sentenced on May 31st, but faces up to 50 years in prison. During the trial itself, there were a few twists and turns, with the prosecution mostly focusing on the inconsistencies of Traconis' 3 police interrogations, the alibi script, and the testimony of Fotis Doulos' former employee, Pavel Gumeny, that pointed to the idea that Traconis had hated Jennifer Farber Doulos. So here are 5 takeaways from the trial and my thoughts. Mover Nation, I'm Collier Landry. Let's get into it.
Testimony continued today in the most notorious criminal trial in...
When I was 12 years old, my testimony sent my father to prison for murdering my mother. I decided at an early age that our trauma should not be what defines us. It's what we choose to do with it that does. I'm here to share my unique perspective on true crime, mental health, society, and popular culture, albeit with a slight sense of humor. I'm Collier Landry, and welcome to my show. Mover Nation, wherever you may be and however you may be listening, thank you for making me a part of your day. I'm Collier Landry, and this is the show where I offer you my unique take on true crime, mental health, society, and popular culture, and albeit with a slight sense of humor. Thanks for joining me. A lot of you have been following this whole trial with me, and I have some very interesting thoughts. I spoke to a psychotherapist yesterday for about an hour and a half, not for my own personal benefit, but discussing this whole Michelle Traconis situation and her thoughts in this. And I want to share those and my 5 general takeaways with all of this. But first, I have some housekeeping that I want to go over with you guys. And welcome to all of my YouTube channel members, all my Patreon subscribers. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for your patronage. It helps keep the lights on, helps keep the show going, and I greatly appreciate it. We have a couple of things coming up. So March is finally upon us. Spring is in the air. We are hopefully done with our rainstorms here in California, but we do have a few more coming up this week. I'm just over the rain. I know the rest of the country is freezing, or where you might be in the part of the world, you might have wacky weather. I think everybody's experiencing it, but I am someone who enjoys my sunshine and warm weather, and we have not had much of that lately. I had a fantastic birthday yesterday. I actually celebrated. I went to the Lakers game and watched a milestone, LeBron James crossing 40,000 points, which was the first time in NBA history, and I guarantee the last time that any of us who are watching this video will ever see it happen again, because it's just such a unique and rare thing that has happened. So congratulations to LeBron James, and congratulations to Caitlin Clark, who also yesterday or today has passed Pistol Pete Maravich's record, which has been standing for 53 years for the most points scored in a collegiate career, in an NCAA collegiate career. She passed that playing my Ohio State Buckeyes. And congratulations to her. History is being made all around us, and it's pretty awesome in the sports world. So a few housekeeping notes. So next weekend is the Oscars, March 9th. And for all of my channel members, all of my Patreon subscribers, we are going to do an Oscar contest. And if you are a member, I'm going to put a link after this episode into our private members section or in the Discord and on our Patreon as well, with a link to the ballot. Whoever wins gets a free t-shirt. If there's a tie, we will do something else, but we're going to stagger a few prizes. But the first one's going to be a Collier Landry Show t-shirt, which will be sent to you and as a thank you. So I hope you all participate. It'll be fun. I love the Oscars. We'll do a little Oscar thing next weekend as well. I'm very excited about that because, obviously, as you know, I spent a lot of time working in the film business, and can't wait to bring you some of those guests who I was hanging out with some of them last night, and they want to be a part of the show. So I'm very excited. So there's that. And let me see what else. Other housekeeping notes. Oh, so speaking of films and the film world, we are going to start implementing this month for all the Patreon and channel members benefits on our second tier. We have a new tier that's available, the Thriver tier. It's our $7 tier. You can join our audiovisual club, where at least once a month, we are going to do a live watch party where we will all watch a documentary. And this month is going to be our first ever watch party. We're going to watch my documentary, A Murder in Mansfield. So I'm going to make that open to everyone who is on the lower tiers this month. And then starting in April, that will become a higher paid tier where we will all be able to interact. And it'll be a lot of fun. And I've been watching a lot of documentaries because I love documentaries. And I can't wait to share my unique perspective with the true crime element of that, but also my perspective as a filmmaker. So I'm very excited about that. Our Discord community is growing, and that is free for you to join for the basic level channel on the Discord. You can interact with everyone. And then there's obviously member channels that are hidden, and they are unlocked once you become a member of a paid tier as well. The same goes for the Patreon members that are also free and versus our paid subscribers. We have some new emojis too. If you check them out, if you're on the channel, we have Professor Marisol, and we have our new sub emoji, and we also have new icons for all the memberships here on YouTube as well. So a lot going on. Court McNeil and I have been hard at work to really cultivate this channel. Karen Fan, Gen X Granny, shout out to you guys for also helping with all of this. It's been amazing, and I cannot thank you enough because our little community is growing, and I'm loving that so much. And by the way, for those of you also keeping track, I did a juice fast, a juice cleanse for my kickoff for my birthday this week, which was absolutely, let me tell you, kind of miserable. But I got through it. And I lost 6 pounds, and I'm very excited about that. So a new year, new health regimen, lots of new things happening, lots of chapters wrapping up, and I'm very excited that you are all a part of this journey. So speaking of wrapping up chapters, so yes, on Friday, March 1st, Michelle Traconis was convicted of all counts in her trial, which has been, it has been... a lot. And, it's been a lot to unpack, I think, for everyone that has watched it and participated. And, look, people are using the Professor Marisol icon right now. That will be reserved for our Word of the Day segment. I'm still making the graphics for that, by the way, guys. But that will be happening very, very soon as well. It's a lot of work putting all this together. I don't know if you guys realize that. It is a tremendous amount of work. I mean, I didn't realize it when I started doing this. I've almost been doing these lives for like a year now, and I'm pretty excited. So thank you all for participating and engaging. It's awesome. So anyways, so Michelle Traconis convicted on all counts on Friday. I was actually, to be honest with you, a little surprised because the jury had been deliberating, and they'd asked a few questions over the, they were given the case on Tuesday night, and Tuesday afternoon, and they spent two full days deliberating and asked a couple of questions. They asked about what the additional charges were in terms of tampering with evidence and hindering prosecution. They asked for some clarification on that. So I thought personally, like, okay, well, maybe she's not going to be convicted on all counts, but they returned a guilty verdict on all counts. And, she was free on bail up until that point. And the judge decided to offer her a $6 million bond to stay out until May 31st, which her father, who is apparently a cardiac surgeon, is obviously desperately trying to raise for her freedom. It's absolutely insane to me because I look at this case in a very unique way. And yes, I'd love to hear in the comments if you guys think that the jury got it right, they got it wrong. I think they got it how they saw it. They obviously were there for all the testimony. I realize those alibi scripts that they had were pretty damning, and Michelle Traconis's very selective memory on things also seemed to be a little bit of a ruse for the jury and in the court, and not understanding English and things. I think they got it right. So, but you know, who knows? They are going to obviously appeal this decision and et cetera, and we'll see how this all plays out. Also, her quote, co-defendant Kent Mawhinney is also going to stand trial as well. And yes, Michelle Bergman says she did not seem to feel any remorse. And yeah, I think a lot of her comments were very damning. There was a comment that was made, something about being the havoc that Jennifer Farber-Dulos's disappearance had caused her family and her kid, because I guess her daughter was photographed, and they showed a photo in the news media, and she was said something to the effect of, "I hope that they bury her next to the dog," which the family dog had died, you know, a few months prior. That was a big deal because the kids couldn't see the dog. And Fotis Doulos was very upset about that. I'm going to do a separate video, by the way, covering Michelle Traconis' sort of backstory, because I find it very interesting, because I draw a lot of parallels between Michelle Traconis and my father's mistress, Sherry Campbell, at the time of my mother's murder. And that was one of the things I was discussing with this psychotherapist yesterday, because they were familiar with the case and my father's case, and we were just discussing some similarities. And, you know, kind of the whole Babe in the Woods routine of not knowing, oh, I didn't know about Collier's mom, I didn't know that Jack was married, et cetera, et cetera. And like how believable that is. And also how fortunate certain people were not charged in certain things, and how these relationships with people who are psychopaths and who create this kind of chaos. And I think that we all would agree, because as the court agreed back in December of 2023, that Jennifer Farber-Dulos is in fact dead, and she was murdered by Fotis Doulos, who is obviously no longer with us because he decided to take the easy way out in January of 2020. But did leave us a note saying that Michelle Traconis had nothing to do with it, which is, I mean, you know, it's all just so very, very strange. And so one of the things we were discussing is the fact that my father's girlfriend and or mistress at the time and his and her uncle, who was my father's business partner, never got charged, even though there was items found like the concrete from my mother's grave on his property, conveniently around the same time my father was arrested. So there's all these things that were very interesting in the way that people who are psychopaths seem to draw in other people into their chaos. And when you think about relationships and the way that people who are like what I believe Fotis Doulos was, which is a psychopath, you know, again, as I say on this channel all the time, I am not a lawyer. I am not a psychologist. I am not in law enforcement. I'm just a guy who's been through a lot of shit. But my unique perspective here is that he was a psychopath and that he did take the life of his wife. And he dragged a lot of people into this, including Michelle Traconis and including this Kent Mowinney, and then this Pavel Gamini. Oh, and I just spilled coffee all over my keyboard. Well, that's not good. That's not good, guys. We're going to just clean this really fast. Sorry about that. Darn you, coffee. Why did you ruin my day? He dragged her into a lot of shit. And I think that was something that that we tend to forget, is that and that I thought maybe she would be seen as more of a victim. That's why when I originally started talking about this, is she Lady Macbeth? Is she a victim? And I think obviously the jury feels that she was Lady Macbeth. I think that she is somewhere in the middle. I personally have felt that she was dragged into this, but I think that she participated too. So I don't think that she was someone who was the conspirer of this. I think people like my father, who are very good at being master manipulators and controlling individuals, are able to gaslight and manipulate people into their actions. And they don't care about the consequences to anyone else. So Fotis Doulos did not care who he involved, because it's all about him. And as the same thing was with my father. So when you bring these people in, they're just pawns. They're just tools in a tool belt that they can pull out and they can use, and then they can just discard. Everyone is dispensable to them. Now, Kent Mowinney made a statement. I'm going to play it in a second, but there is evidence of against him, and he is going to stand trial. I'm not sure when his trial date is, But it's interesting. We're also going to watch a quick video about what the implications of Michelle Tracones' conviction are going to be against the case in the case against Mwinney, which there's a lot of speculation of how he was involved. But a lot of people were saying that he did show up at Fotis' house at 7:40 a.m. Just in case that Michelle Tracones did not make it back in time for a phone call, and with his ability to help Fotis conspire. So I don't know how. I mean, again, the big missing piece of all this, and I've said this many times, is we look at these cases, and I still go through the same thing with my mother's case and with my father. And I'm working on some other projects that are involving that right now. We're in discussions about the scenarios that happened in the days after the murder. And, you know, there's a lot that you don't know because you have someone who, you know, you have a party that is obviously they've lost their life. And then you have the person who's convicted who's not going to say anything. And the way that situations and people have been manipulated in these situations, and the fact of the matter is the people that know what happened are Jennifer Farber Doulos and Fotis Doulos, and they are both not with us anymore. And so the truth is all sort of very speculative. That's why you have 5 years of an investigation and a trial, leading up to a trial of Michelle Tracones, where there are no real answers. It's all just based on speculation and time and cell phones and ring cameras on doorbells and security footage on busy streets. And piecing these things together. And that's an interesting thing when you think about law enforcement's involvement in these types of situations. And again, as even just going through my own case recently with some producers, we were discussing of the things that led up and the evidence that I had gathered, the evidence that Detective David Messmore had gathered, and then the resistance from the district attorney's office and his own police chief as well. Again, sort of reticence to pursue any charges against my father based upon the word of an 11-year-old boy. That's a story for another day, which if you are part of our AV club, we will be showing that this month in probably 2 weeks. We will do a screening of A Murder in Mansfield, and then you will get a lot more backstory on my story if you are not already familiar with it. And kind of like that. But back to the casualties and these five takeaways that I want to discuss. So regarding her involvement, so prosecutors had always said that Jennifer Farber Doulos' murder was deliberate and intentional because Michelle Tracones was angry and fed up with the divorce case. So she worked with Fotis to make it happen. But the defense had always claimed that it was ultimately Fotis who was responsible, and of course that Michelle was an innocent bystander. So really, was she? So obviously the jury determined that she was not an innocent bystander, but the crux of this, of the argument from the prosecution on why she's not an innocent bystander, was that they had obtained what are now being referred to as the alibi scripts. And I can remember, and these alibi scripts, I can remember them in my own story, but the alibi scripts were on a black computer back during a search of Fotis Doulos' home on June 9th of 2019, which was about 2 weeks after the disappearance of Jennifer Farber Doulos. Now, Michelle Tracones had previously told the police that they had been advised by a divorce attorney at the time to write out the timelines. And what's interesting is, why were they told to write out the timelines of the disappearance of the day? And I can remember as a child, when my mother went missing, my father sitting with his divorce attorney in our dining room and discussing things. And I'm pretty sure that's exactly what he was doing, was coming up with this timeline that happened when my mother went missing. And I think that is something that a lot of people, to me, it seems like good due diligence if you're trying to document, okay, like this is what I remember happened. But it also seems super suspicious, super sus when you're putting something together. And it's like, why do you have to have an alibi script? Why can't you just answer? And why are they conferring about said alibi scripts? So that is my first real takeaway of this. And so The jury was shown three documents, with the first mentioning sending emails to Jennifer and Michelle, a trip to Starbucks at 7 p.m. that she wrote, which occurred at the West, she wrote West Hartford Starbucks, two Frappuccinos. I do not like the sandwich. And the trip to Starbucks was made after after Michelle Traconis and Fotis Doulos were seen driving the route along Albany Avenue, where Fotis was stopping and tossing trash bags that police later discovered had contained Jennifer Farber Doulos' DNA. The second document was a more detailed timeline that began with, quote, taking a shower with Fotis at 6:40 a.m. and went on to describe the outfit that she wore and cooking scrambled eggs for her daughter. And the third timeline appeared to be a call log with documented incoming, outgoing, and canceled calls and the duration of each one. So again, these alibi scripts seem to be the one of the main things that I think the jury just really found, okay, well, if you're innocent, if you haven't committed any crime, and if you are really this babe in the woods, why are you doing this? Which, of course, her defense was saying, well, Fotis told me to do this. Which, I'm not saying that Fotis Doulos did not tell her to do that, but again, this is something that I think could be referred to as the main smoking gun in this case with her behavior. And it's like, why do you need to have a story if you don't need to have a story? I think you catch my drift. The second would be this surveillance footage, which was of a Ford Raptor truck with Fotis Doulos driving along Albany Avenue, where he dumped numerous plastic trash bags into numerous trash receptacles along Albany Avenue, just right down the street from that Starbucks in Stamford, Connecticut. And this was something, again, that looks super suspicious, super sus, as we like to say. The state presented surveillance footage of what appeared to be Fotis Doulos and Michelle Traconis in the Ford Raptor dumping trash into various bins in Hartford. Sorry, in Hartford, not in Stamford. Two separate cameras captured what appeared to be Fotis's truck driving past the plaza at 7:27 p.m. and heading toward Hartford. The city cameras then captured the truck along its four-mile route in the area of Albany Avenue, with Fotis Doulos throwing out trash bags and Michelle as the passenger. And in one video, as Fotis is seen getting out of the truck and putting an envelope down the sewer drain, Traconis is seen opening the passenger door and reaching down to the sidewalk. That envelope later was found to contain license plates that were once registered to a truck and a vehicle owned by Fotis Doulos. And they were all sort of scratched out as well. When police found it, Cat Loves Catskills, thank you so much for the super sticker. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. And also thank you so much, Wishful Makeuping, for the super sticker. Like you say, the truth flows and lies do not, as Cat Loves Catskills says. Yes, absolutely. The truth should be so pure that it flows and lies do not. So regarding those alibi scripts, again, why do you need alibi scripts if you're telling the truth? Something that has always been called into question as I was a child with my father, because people would allege that, oh, okay, well, you were coached by police. And my father, of course, alleged this as well. And I'm like, well, first of all, police weren't there. Police didn't hear what I had heard. And I told the police what happened before anyone else did. So I didn't make up the story, and nobody fed me the story because I'm the one that told the story in the first place, because it was the truth. But it becomes really hard, and we become very, we sort of become very pedantic when breaking down these stories and asking why people have these recollections. And, well, are you sure you really remember it this way? It becomes very different, but difficult. But again, if it's the truth, it flows out really easily. And no one can call it into question because it's irrefutable. So back to the vehicle on Albany Avenue. It wasn't until 7:54 p.m. that the truck was spotted pulling into the Starbucks Plaza parking lot. Now, the defense had admitted that, yes, she was in the truck, but that didn't mean that she was culpable. Traconis insisted that she did not know what Fotis was doing and that she was on the phone with her with both her mother and daughter during the, quote, trip down Albany Avenue. The defense also said that she was taken by surprise and by the detour, and even asked Fotis at one point, what are we doing here? So you have the alibi scripts. First takeaway, the surveillance footage. Number two. Now we get to the smoke, and this is the chimney smoke. And so this is something that came into question a little while ago, a couple weeks ago, when they were showing this chimney smoke that was coming out of the chimney at 4 Jefferson Crossing, which was a property that Fotis Doulos also owned, that he was working on selling, and was cleaning the residence, and a real estate agent was in there, and Michelle Traconis was in there alone, and there's this chimney smoke happening, and people were calling to question, like, why are you lighting a fire? It's May. It's springtime, almost summertime, and why are you lighting a fire? It's not cold outside. So prosecutors say that on the day of Jennifer's disappearance, smoke could be seen wafting out of the chimney at 4 Jefferson Crossing 3 separate times. The state also said that Traconis had made 5 trips within 4 hours back and forth from the 80 Mountain Spring Road, a 4 Group property, which is also owned by Fotis Doulos and his company, 4 Group, to 4 Jefferson Crossing, the home that he shared with Fotis and her daughter. So that was where Michelle Traconis was living with him. Phone data and surveillance revealed that Traconis was alone at the home when at least the first 2 fires took place. The first trip to Mountain Spring Road occurred at 1:36 p.m., where she stayed for 5 minutes before returning at 1:41 p.m. She then returned at 2:01 p.m., stayed for 23 minutes, and then returned to Jefferson Crossing at 2:24. She then stayed there for more than an hour and a half when she took her third trip to Mountain Spring Road at 3:55 p.m. So the prosecution had asked, what is she doing between trips 2 and 3, between 2:24 p.m. and 3:55, when she is alone at 4 Jefferson Crossing? She's burning something. Now, the security footage from a neighbor showed smoke coming out of the chimney at 2:56 p.m. and again at 3:25 p.m. She went back to Jefferson Crossing at 4:04 and returned to Mountain Spring Road at 4:23 p.m., where Pavel Gamini, who worked for Fotis Doulos, who was given and granted immunity in this case in exchange for his testimony against Michelle Traconis, where Pavel Gamini had shown up around a half an hour later. The three then left Mountain Spring Road at 5:02 p.m., allegedly to clean Gamini's truck. She went back to 80 Mountain Spring Road a fifth time at 5:23 p.m., and then 4 minutes later returned to Jefferson Crossing. The last footage of the smoke could be seen at 6:42 p.m. So she did not mention the trips or the fires in her timeline documents or her police interviews until the officers confronted her about them. So this was a big deal to the jury, because they're like, well, why didn't you tell us about these, Michelle? If you're making this script of things that happened, why wouldn't you remember lighting these fires and making these trips? Traconis's friend had testified that she always had a fire going regardless of the season or weather. And the defense noted that items found in the trash, such as sponges, trash bags, and clothing, etc., were all easily burnable. So why not burn those items as well? Maybe she couldn't burn them, because not everything can burn that quickly in a fire if you're trying to get rid of evidence. So who knows what exactly was being burned in that chimney at the time. Again, all of this, obviously, the jury has found her guilty. So obviously there's a good reason why they did this, right? And obviously they thought all of these things, all these little takeaways that I'm describing, were clearly reasons why she is guilty and on all charges. So now we get into the Pavel Gamini testimony, but I do want to play something really fast because now we have Kent Mulvaney, who is going to stand trial coming up, and he recently gave a statement on Saturday, and we're going to check that out in 1 second as soon as I can bring it up here in the extra sharing of the screen. There we are. There we go. Let us check this out.
Well, a dramatic verdict in Connecticut nearly 5 years after mother of five, Jennifer Dulos, disappeared. The jury convicting Michelle Traconis on all six counts yesterday, including conspiracy to commit murder, tampering with physical evidence as well, and hindering the prosecution. Now, Traconis dated Jennifer Dulos' estranged husband, Fotis Dulos, back in 2019. That's when Jennifer went missing in May of that year. Her body was never discovered, so there was a lot of circumstantial evidence in this case. Officials later declared her legally dead. That's when prosecutors charged Fotis with her murder. They say Traconis was a co-conspirator and helped cover it all up. So in addition to Michelle Traconis, there is another key person in this case who did not take the witness stand. We're talking about her co-defendant, Kent Mulvaney. He's in awaiting trial right now on charges of conspiracy to commit murder as well. Although McKinney was on the list of witnesses who could have been called to testify, neither prosecutors nor the defense put him on the stand. His attorney saying last month that despite what was stated in court, his client did not invoke his Fifth Amendment right to avoid testifying. Now today, his attorney sent Fox 61 this statement. I'm going to read it in part, quote, "The senseless murder of Jennifer Farber was a horrific crime. We hope the verdict in the Traconis case provides a measure of relief for the Farber family and friends. That verdict has nothing to do with Kent Mulvaney. However, his name was barely mentioned over 6 weeks of trial, and for good reason, he was not involved in the death of Jennifer Dulos," end quote. Mulvaney has been released on house arrest since May, a date for his trial not yet scheduled, but of course we'll be following that as we have throughout these 5 years.
So, very interesting because, again, his lawyer is now saying that he, of course, was never mentioned during the trial, so he's not involved at all, which of course his lawyer is going to say for sure. But it'll be interesting to see what happens, because is there an angle now where the prosecution just basically tries to force Kent Mulvaney into making a plea deal? Because personally, she's facing, I've heard 40 years, some people say 50 years in prison. That would be enough to scare the living bejesus out of me as well. And again, a lot of cases, as I say many times on this show, I am not a lawyer. I am not a psychologist. I am not in law enforcement. I'm just a guy who's been through a lot of shit. Promise the t-shirt is coming in the merchandise store probably this week. I know I've been saying that for a while now. I apologize. But the thing is Michelle Traconis is not testifying on her behalf. And you have a situation where this guy is now looking at doing time because she has been convicted, and now Kent Mulvaney just might make a plea deal. And most of the time, a lot of cases are settled in plea deal situations because now the prosecution can just literally go and say, well, we've got a conviction over here and she's facing 40 to 50 years in prison. Do you want to just take this and do 10 years? Who knows? We will see how all this plays out because it's a lot. And again, I still very much believe that the mastermind of all of this, and I think everyone believes the mastermind of all of this, was Fotis Dulos. But that does not exonerate any of these people who aided him in the disappearance and murder of Jennifer Farber-Doulos. But it does make an interesting case of reflection, which I'm going to talk about a little later in the episode, of people's involvement. And as I said at the top of the episode, thinking about my father's own mistress being involved and being roped in by my father, who is a psychopath, and how all of that played out. And she did not get arrested or anything like that. She pled the fifth on the witness stand. But how all of that played out, and it could have been much worse for a lot of people involved when you're dragged into these situations. So it's something to think about for sure. So we have the smoke. We have Pavel Gumeny's testimony. So the thing is that is one of the last things, point number four, takeaway number four, is the testimony of Pavel Gumeny, who was Fotis Doulos' employee for many, many years, and who was offered immunity in this trial to cooperate against, you know, testifying for the prosecution against Michelle Traconis. So Pavel Gumeny had testified for 2 days about the interactions with his former boss, Fotis Doulos, and Michelle Traconis around the time that Jennifer Farber-Doulos disappeared on May the 24th, 2019. He testified that he heard Michelle refer to Jennifer Doulos as a, quote, bitch, at least twice, including once where she allegedly said, that bitch, quote, that bitch should be buried right next to this dog, referring to the family dog that had passed away earlier that the children were not allowed to see, which, again, I think painted a lot of her character in the trial to the jury, that she was a very cold and callous woman. And, you know, she had been the paramour, as Jennifer Farber-Doulos had referred to her as. She had been the paramour in the relationship prior to the divorce. And, you know, she obviously was becoming involved with the children's lives, and Jennifer Farber-Doulos did not like that either. I wouldn't like that. I don't think any mother would want the mistress involved in the lives of the children. That was a major line in the sand, or a crossing of the Rubicon, that my father made when my father introduced me to his mistress at the time, which ultimately led to the murder of my mother. And that was one of those things that they said, nope, that my mother was like, Jack, and I later obviously found this out because I didn't know my father was having multiple affairs when I was a child. But that was the line in the sand with my mother. She said, you can do whatever you want, but do not involve our son. And the moment that he did, that was the deal breaker for her. And that's when she filed for divorce. And that's when all the chaos ensued. And the premeditation began on my father's side. So it's interesting to see her perspective and the way that the prosecution was very successful in painting this character of her. And she, again, might have been just saying this just to say it. It might not have been that she actually knew that she was going to get buried. She was just angry. And apparently this was related to something about, to something regarding her daughter's photograph coming out into the media as well. And this was after Jennifer Farber-Doulos' disappearance. So there's a lot going on, but again, paints a really bad character for her. He also said that he heard Michelle Traconis say that I'm going to kill that effing bitch when she turns up, and also referring to the complaint. And this was after, again, the media had posted photos of Michelle Traconis' daughter. So the prosecution also said that Pavel Gumeny's testimony proved that Traconis had hated Jennifer, and that in itself was a motive to commit the crime. The defense brought up his immunity agreement and thought it was, quote, interesting that he suddenly remembered all these conversations after the agreement was in place, and that Gumeny had not mentioned this during his police interviews. So, you know, John Schoenhorn, who was Michelle Traconis' attorney, I remember him talking about this, and it was very convenient. But honestly, if you were holding out for an immunity deal in a trial like this, and in a case like this where they're charging everyone. I would probably hold that information and ask for immunity too. I don't blame him. He's got children. He is an immigrant to this country. He seems to be a very hardworking guy. I think he's a real innocent pawn in this. And now his name has been dragged through the mud. And he even said on the witness stand that like, he's just looking to get back to normal after testifying because he wants to put all this behind him. So good on him for getting a deal and getting himself out of this, honestly. So, I don't think that shows anything of it was interesting that he suddenly remembered this. I think that he was withholding that information saying, look, I'll give you more information, but I need, or his lawyer says this, or my client needs to not be charged with anything. He wants immunity. I think that's totally fair. So I don't think the defense painting him in that light did anything to help their case other than make them look terrible. And obviously the jury agreed. So number five, are the three different police interviews. Now, this was something that I had questioned many times, and you guys had corrected me in the comments because I wasn't sure. A lot of people weren't sure. You couldn't see them. She's had many attorneys, but I was under the impression that for whatever reason that Michelle Traconis was A, doing these interviews with police without an interpreter, without being offered an interpreter, which I'm sure, or she refused an interpreter, but claiming that she doesn't understand English, listening to obviously the trial in Spanish through her ear being translated. Also that she didn't have an attorney present, but apparently she did have an attorney present every single time she was being questioned. I just thought it was very strange on how some of the questioning was directed towards her by detectives, and then the way that they were trying to manipulate her and get a rise out of her by suggesting that that Fotis Doulos had relationships with other women, which was completely not true. Again, as I have said, or completely untrue. Again, as I have said many times, I said in other videos around this case, police can lie to you when they're interrogating you. They are allowed to lie to you to try to get probable cause to put together that probable cause affidavit to get you arrested and to lead to a prosecution. They are allowed to do that. Now, lawyers can't do that. They can't do that in court, but police can do that. If you guys have watched American Nightmare recently, which is literally a nightmare, they are interviewing Aaron Quinn, and they are telling him that he failed a polygraph test and that he possibly murdered his girlfriend, which was obviously completely untrue. She was kidnapped, and this whole thing, if you guys haven't seen on Netflix, it's fabulous. I just interviewed his now wife, Heather Quinn, last week, talking about this. And, the police can do whatever they want in interrogation. That's why it's best to just lawyer. I'm not saying anything. Even when you get arrested, you have the right to remain silent. That is what the Miranda Act is all about. So you do not self-incriminate. So always keep that in mind. Don't talk to the police. You want to cooperate, but also anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law, as the Miranda rights suggest. So the three different police interviews. Takeaway number five. Multiple witnesses testified throughout the trial regarding the discrepancy between the three interrogations Michelle Traconis had with police during the investigation. There was a witness for the defense regarding memory, as well as a language expert to speak to how she may have processed or understood the questions, since English is not her first language. Police stated that in each of her interviews, Traconis offered claims which conflicted with her other interviews and sometimes even portions of the same interview. When she was confronted with the conflicts in the information, she would only then provide, quote, more truthful information, sometimes modifying or changing her answer in the middle of it. The first interview was the one where she indicated that Fotis was home all morning and that they had had a shower together around 6:40 a.m., but when further pressed, admitted that maybe he wasn't home, quote, the entire morning. The second interview was where she indicated that she didn't see him until 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock that same day. And the third interview was where she changed her story, indicating that she had not been cleaning windows at 80 Mountain Spring Road, as she had said in the first two, but rather had been cleaning bathrooms. Now, I don't know about you, but great song, by the way, by Van Morrison, Cleaning Windows. Total aside. I know the difference between cleaning a toilet cleaning a window, but Who knows? Now, Professor Elizabeth Loftus, who was from the University of California, Irvine, who I had talked about in the last couple of last episode about the Trakonas trial, she was up. She is a she is an expert witness for the defense in the field of memory recollection, and she discussed that. Now, she has worked with high-profile clients and cases which the prosecution brought up in cross-examination, working with the Menendez brothers, O.J. Simpson, Harvey Weinstein, and many, many others. High-profile cases, I believe, well over 300, working for the defense, and only one time did she work for the prosecution. So they brought a lot of things out against the defense's witnesses. And this professor, Elizabeth Loftus, was saying that, quote, in defense of the field of memory, memory does not work like a recording device, and that perhaps Trakonas' inconsistencies were due to time passing or post-event suggestions. As I've said many times, the truth is the easiest thing to remember and is usually so pure that it flows. Now, again, the prosecution on cross-examination brought up all of the high-profile cases that she had worked for, which I think also was a major, major blow to the defense in the eyes of the jury, because the prosecution was able to link her to notorious people such as O.J. Simpson, right? And Harvey Weinstein. I mean, those are big, big names. And the Menendez brothers, who are currently in prison, right? And even though new evidence has come to light, they still were found guilty of killing the parents, right? So really painting her character in terms of the people who she's appeared for. They also discussed her hourly wage for appearing on the witness stand and for the work that she had done for Michelle Trakonas' defense team and getting paid $700 an hour, $800 an hour, $600 an hour, you know, insane amounts of money. And, you know, again, she's a professional and she's allowed to be paid, but it's interesting that the prosecution was very good at painting all these people in a very, very bad light that the defense brought up. Then there was Victoria Marion, a language expert who also took the stand for the defense to testify that Trakonas had a, quote, medium proficiency at best in English and used Spanish grammar when speaking English. Her complexity level of English was low, and she was at times unable to follow directions. So, look. In Michelle Trakonas' past life, she had worked even for ESPN. She had many successful businesses that she had done when she lived in Florida. She had a daughter. She moved to Connecticut and in with Fotis Doulos. Fotis Doulos his name is Turkish, but I believe he is Greek. And he obviously doesn't speak Spanish, so he speaks English and she speaks English. So obviously they were able to understand. And she had a proficiency for how the language works and how the language structured. And she chose to do those depositions without a translator. So obviously she understood English. It would have made a lot more sense if she had said, hey, I need to talk to the translator. The translator needs to explain this to me. Because after the fact, you know, to try to claim that. And one of the clear things for me is during the trial, when the judge had asked her if she was going to testify in her own defense, right? She responded without even waiting for the translator to translate, you know, if she was denying, you know, if she was giving up her right to testify in her own defense, she said, sí, which is Spanish, obviously, for yes. So again, there is a lot of evidence that the jury had to weigh in committing to this verdict of guilty on all these charges. And to me, it feels like maybe they felt like they were being gamed a lot in the courtroom by her and her defense, that she was being prevaricative with police in her interviews, that she was conveniently not remembering things, that she was conveniently saying, I don't understand, that her wanton and sort of callous comments to Pavel Gamini had a massive impact on them as well and on painting her character. And I think the prosecution did a great job. And I think, you guys can let me know in the comments below if you guys think that they got it right or wrong. But, justice has been served, if you will. And now Michelle Traconis will be sentenced on May 31st. Now, here is my unique perspective and takeaway. I can't wait till I get the graphics ready for this, but this is my unique perspective. So as I told you at the top of the show, I had a conversation for about an hour and a half with a psychotherapist yesterday who's intimately familiar with my own personal case of my mother's murder, and personally familiar with my father, and the behaviors of psychopathy and different personality disorders. And we were discussing the Michelle Traconis trial, and we were discussing how relationships in general and how people who are, people who are in relationships with psychopaths or people that have these various personality disorders can often be roped in and become willing participants in situations that they normally would not do or would not participate in. I think back to my father's girlfriend or mistress, rather, and then girlfriend, how, being a young woman, 28 years old, being pregnant with my half sister at the time, and, she had signed an N before her name on a contract, which was the house that my father had purchased where he buried my mother's body underneath the basement floor of. And she had signed an initial and to make it look like my mother's name, which was Noreen Schmidt Boyle. And so essentially forging a document in a way, but had said to me personally when I was a child, because I asked her about that later on after my father's conviction when I was a teenager. And she said, your father came into the room and asked me to put the initial N before my name. And they weren't married either, so she had no reason writing her last name as Boyle. But I think back to that particular conversation and the way that, and in discussing with law enforcement around my father's case and relating it back again to this Traconis trial, how that one key moment in time, right, where my father, the real estate agent left the room, he goes, oh, do me a favor, just put an N before your name. Very innocently. And she's like, well, why? He's like, no, just do it. It's just for purposes. I didn't want to explain it, right? It made her look like she was maybe a quote co-conspirator. Now, she was never charged. She pled the fifth on the witness stand, and there was no, to my knowledge and to the police, and I've had these discussions many times, there was no knowledge of her being anywhere involved in any of this, anything that happened to my mother. And I firmly 100% believe that. However, she was roped into the situation. And I think about Michelle Traconis and maybe her personality, which seems to be very spicy, very fiery. I don't know. And again, I'm going to do a separate video about her background at one point, but she, who the woman that she was before all of this. But one of the things that I think is very key is that Michelle Traconis, maybe her personal anger and feelings towards Jennifer Doulos helped blind her to her potential involvement in any of this. So let's just say that she was not aware of what Fotis Doulos was dumping on Albany Avenue on that evening after the disappearance of Jennifer Farber Doulos. Maybe she wasn't aware of this. Maybe she was just like my father's girlfriend was saying, oh, he's like, dump these license plates, or hey, dump this in, or hey, write this out. Maybe she was just because she was maybe blinded by her own obsession over getting one over on Jennifer Farber Doulos, or maybe she was obviously complicit and maybe she was a complete partner in all of this and in the death of her. But I think a lot about that, and it calls into question really being careful and cautious of people who you involve in your life, and ways that other people's actions, whether you're dating them, whether you're married to them, whether you're friends with them, whether they're your relatives, the way that the actions of other people can often affect people, what, you know, if they're innocent or if they are complicit, and the ways that manipulation can be handed down on people who are just maybe either just riled up, and you see the way that our society becomes very polarizing, the concept of the other, the way that people can get very vitriolic and venomous towards certain very polarizing positions, and how that can sometimes be weaponized and manipulated by people who are psychopathic and drag you into their web of lies and deceit, and ultimately maybe end you up in prison. That to me is my biggest takeaway. And I'm not defending Michelle Traconis in this at all, because the jury has spoken. She is guilty, but it is definitely a cautionary tale for anyone who becomes involved with someone who may have these particular tendencies and be easily manipulated and be blinded by their own hubris and get themselves into a massive world of shit. And, you know, she's looking at 40 to 50 years. That's, you know, even if she was just the innocent person that she claimed and she was just angry at Jennifer Farber-Doulos, she clearly, as the jury thought, wrapped herself up into Fotis Doulos' web of lies and deceit. And that ultimately is her downfall, and ultimately was her downfall. Now, I'm sure this case will go to appeal. We'll see if this $6 million bond gets posted for her to be out for another 2.5 months. I mean, her family, and you know, an additional takeaway here is, let's not get lost in the fact that there are 5 young children who are without both a mother and a father, and who have been so for almost five years in May. Will have been without their mother, and for over four years now have been without their father, and who have nothing but questions, and will have nothing but questions growing up, because, you know, look, I know what happened to my mother, and I still had questions. It's not an easy situation to be in. You also have Michelle Traconis' daughter, who is actually, you know, is much older. I believe she's in her 20s, you know, out of college now, I believe. I'm not 100% sure. Again, now dealing with the loss of her mother and her mother's involvement in such a horrific and heinous crime. We shouldn't forget the ancillary victims in all of these things, in all of these scenarios. You know, the families that surround these individuals that commit these heinous acts is something that we have to approach with some compassion and understanding, and know that it is very difficult to grow up and to face the day, if you will, knowing that your family was involved in something so horrific. So, cautionary tale and a little bit of compassion. Mover Nation, we get through another one. I want to say thank you so much to all my YouTube channel members, all my Patreon members, all my channel subscribers. If you wouldn't mind, please click the like and subscribe if you are enjoying this content. We had 700 some people in this live. This is by far and away my highest record live ever, by almost double. So thank you all for tuning in. That is really awesome. I love how this channel is growing, and I love how you guys are engaging with my material and my content, and how you guys are engaging with one another in the chats as well. It's incredible. I'm seeing all these names that I don't even recognize in the chat right now. And I want to say thank you to everyone who has shown up and just participating and engaging with the community. Mover Nation welcomes you. If you subscribe, if you want to join the channel membership, again, we are going to do this month, we are starting my AV club. We're going to watch my film, A Murder in Mansfield, live through Discord. I'll share with you guys all my behind the scenes takes. And then we're going to offer a membership level starting April, where you will be able, it's actually now, the membership level is out. It's a $7 level where you can join, and we're going to do our monthly AV club, where we go over true crime documentaries or documentaries, and you'll get my inside opinion. We'll watch it all together. We'll have a good time. It's like a watch party. It's a watch party, right? If you have not joined the Discord, it is free to join the Discord for the general YouTube member or YouTube subscriber tier. It's free. You guys can engage, and then you can unlock certain channels on the Discord as you become a member of higher tiers, or a channel member, or a Patreon subscriber. It's all the same. And your support is what helps make this content, keeps the lights on, keeps me here going, researching. A big shout out to my assistant, Court McNeil, who worked really hard on preparing all the information on today's episode. And thank you so much to my channel members. And I'm sorry, my channel admins and moderators for participating in the chat. And if you purchase a super sticker or super chat, thank you all so much. Woo! We get through another one. Mover Nation, I cannot tell you how grateful I am for all of you showing up. On that note, I'm Collier Landry. I'll see you on the next one.
This podcast is made possible by support from listeners just like you. For exclusive content around this podcast, please consider supporting me via Patreon by going to collierlandry.com/support. Please subscribe via Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from, and please leave us a 5-star review. If you want to see video episodes of this podcast, please check out my YouTube channel at youtube.com/collierlandry. You can find links to additional resources in the show notes of today's episode. This podcast is a production of Don't Touch My Radio. Copyright Collier Landry.